TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. All sports, baby! All the time. A division of Bell Media.
Craig McTavish is our new general manager.
Game-saving stop! Hollywood highlight save!
The Flyers are going to beat the Rangers.
Back to Green, he winds up, he scores!
One of the better games I've seen Bernie play.
Ladd versus Bishop, scores!
Plays, the big stories, the biggest news from across the hockey landscape. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us this evening on TSN1290.ca, good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus is on loan from Rick Ralph and the TSN 1290 Roundtable. 1 hour of hockey talk for you on this Wednesday evening, an abbreviated edition, as we welcome in Paul Edmonds in the inside pitch for 2 hours of Gold Eyes and baseball talk from 7 to 9 tonight on TSN 1290. In this coming hour, we're going to be joined by Ryan Rashog from TSN Edmonton to talk about the Oilers' front office moves. We're going to break down the Carolina Hurricanes' power play ahead of tomorrow night's Jets-Hurricanes game at MTS Center, a game you can hear, of course, on TSN 1290, and a couple other interesting segments we hope that we have for you. Gentlemen, Richard, Ezra, good evening. How are you both doing?
Really good. Really good. Good evening, boys. After that Jets game yesterday, that huge shootout win, I don't know if I have any more emotional fortitude left, because that was quite the win. 4 wins in a row here. But I know we have a quick show here to do, and then Saturday we're on the air early. But, you know, these last 4 Jets wins have really, you know, re-energized the hopes of fans in the city. So I'm ready to go once again.
Richie?
Yeah, no, last night's game was an exciting one. Jets came away with the 2 points and obviously make it more interesting coming into tomorrow's big game with Carolina.
Well, let's start off by talking about the playoff stretch drive. We're also going to talk about the Oilers front office moves in this segment. You look at the Jets and, you know, they didn't get much help last night in that, you know, Washington beat up on Toronto. Not much of a surprise given that Toronto was in the second half of a back-to-back and they didn't really need the game. The Islanders, they beat up on the Florida Panthers because, well, as we saw in Winnipeg, the Florida Panthers, I don't think they could beat really the best Highlander team right now. And the Jets did get some help in that the Philadelphia Flyers beat the New York Rangers. As a Jets fan, which team are you looking at as potentially being the one the Jets can overtake? The Capitals, the Islanders, or the Rangers, given the Jets' remaining schedule, all those teams' remaining schedules, and where everything stands at this point in time?
I mean, the Capitals are a tough team to chase right now, being that you've played the same amount of games as them, and you both have 5 games left, but you're 4 points back and you don't have the tiebreaker. So I know you play against them once, but the way they're playing right now, you'd think that they're going to fade eventually, but apparently not. Won their last 8, 9-0-1 and their last 10. I think Washington's a stretch now. The Islanders and the Rangers are really, Drew, the two teams you really have to focus on as a Jets fan. The Rangers, the Jets are tied. With points, Rangers have a game in hand, but the Jets have the tiebreaker, and the Islanders are 3 points up on the Jets, and, you know, 1 game short in terms of regulation wins, but the Jets do play them head to head, so it's a pretty big difference in terms of, you know, as Washington has 4 points up, and they have the regulation edge on the Jets, whereas the Islanders are 3 points up and don't have the regulation edge. So it's a big difference. I think those two New York teams are the ones you got to focus on here.
Yeah, the Rangers have back-to-back games coming up here tomorrow and Friday.
Yeah.
And you have to hope that they lose one of those games. I mean, Richie mentioned the Capitals. For the Jets to catch the Capitals, it's, you know, there's going to have to be a lot of luck involved, and they're going to have to lose 3 or 4 games here. Uh-huh. And that's if the Jets win 4 of their last 5 games. So the Capitals is quite unrealistic at this point. Because 4 points, like Richie mentioned, it's actually 5 points because of the tiebreaker. If the Jets can beat the Capitals,
right,
they get the tiebreaker back. But they need a situation. You need to pick up 5 points, really, not 4.
Mm-hmm.
Because, so actually 6, if you want to overtake them, you'd be tied. six to overtake them, but five to tie, really, when you consider they have the tiebreaker. So really, the Islanders and the Rangers, and the Islanders and the Rangers, the majority of their schedule, we went over it last week on a regular Saturday illegal curve. A lot of their games are against non-playoff teams, so you have to hope that, you know, there's a couple of losses in a row, and you have to get some breathing room, because right now, they keep winning, and there's no breathing room.
Worth pointing out regarding the tiebreaker, we know that the first tiebreaker, of course, is regulation wins. Right now, the Caps have one more regulation win than the Winnipeg Jets. Of course, that if the Jets were ever to end up tied with the Capitals, you figured those numbers might change. The second tiebreaker, if the two teams end up with the same number of points and the same number of regulation wins, is who has the most points in games played between the two teams, an advantage that the Capitals would have based on the strength of their three wins at the MTS Center, three clean wins at the MTS Center, versus the Jets currently one win on in Washington. So it looks like the Jets would lose out, would have to definitely end the year with more regulation wins than the Capitals because the secondary tiebreaker doesn't help them at all.
Unlikely.
Yeah. It's unlikely. You're absolutely right, given the way the Capitals have been playing. Now, they don't have the easiest schedule, but nonetheless, I mean, they have Ottawa and Montreal on the road, and then they finish the year home to Winnipeg, home to Ottawa, and home to Boston.
You have to gain 5 points in five games, Drew.
Not, it's like you said, not terribly realistic. Then you look at the Islanders' schedule, and, you know, Jets fans have to, you know, have to hope for the Leafs tomorrow. That, and the Leafs should take care of business against the Islanders on home ice tomorrow night.
I mean, sure, they're the Leafs, and the Leafs have played really well, but the Islanders are nothing to scoff at.
Right.
And obviously, important to know the Islanders' remainder of their schedule is on the road.
Exactly. Five straight road games. But if the Islanders, you know, if the Leafs take care of business tomorrow night and the Jets take care of business tomorrow night at home, then really the Jets can win out and they can get in.
Also worth noting, the Islanders' road record this year is 12-5-2.
Right. They've been actually far better on the road than they have been at home. But, you know, that's all you can do. It's, I mean, when you don't control your own fate and you don't control your own destiny, you have to do these ifs and whats and hope for the best. Let's shift away from the playoff race, the Eastern Conference playoff race at least, and look to what the Edmonton Oilers did this week with the removal from general manager Steve Tambellini. He got his walking papers. They put Craig McTavish in as general manager, hiring him to be their new GM. Scotty Housen, who used to be with the Oilers organization, was the general manager in Columbus, that reign of terror, and is now back to being the assistant general manager in Edmonton. Are you in favor of the moves made by the Edmonton Oilers this week? Keep in mind, we'll also be talking about this with Ryan Rashog coming up in about 20 minutes' time.
As far as, I guess there's two parts of this as far as what I'd be in favor of. One being firing Steve Tambellini, and the second being the hiring of Craig McTavish and Scott Housen, guys that are previously familiar to the Edmonton Oilers organization. As far as the timing goes, the Oilers have you know, pardon the language, but they've really pooped the bed here. They've completely you know, dropped out of the playoff race. You know, if you want to call it mailed it in, whatever. You know, they're not going to make the playoffs this year. I would say that they haven't taken a step forward as an organization this year. Where's everyone, you know, with the Justin Schultz for Norris now, you know, saying that the Oilers were going to be great this year. If you go back to our season preview show, I said, you know, I think the Oilers are a few years away. Now, you know, I'm not a genius for saying that. A lot of hockey people were saying that, but I think the expectations were a little bit too high this year for the Oilers. And Steve Tambellini is going to get criticized for a lot of the moves that he made, you know, and a lot of people will say that, you know, well, he drafted Yakupov and Hall and all these guys in Eberle, and you know, so he has made some right decisions. But at the end of the day, and Craig McTavish mentioned this in the press conference at Rexall, they have to surround these guys with depth players, you know, and so they made the decision now, and, you know, We'll have to see, you know, what the Oilers do in the offseason. There's a lot of talk about, you know, moving a Jordan Eberle or a Taylor Hall to get some more depth on defense. As far as I'm concerned, the goaltending isn't very good in Edmonton. Devan Dubnyk hasn't had a good year. And the defense is one of the worst in the league when you look at, you know, once you get down to the third, fourth, fifth, sixth spot. So, you know, at the end of the day, they didn't take a step forward as an organization. So Tambellini was the guy that they decided to let go. And I, you know, Drew, I'm surprised that they went with McTavish. I didn't expect McTavish to be the guy that they would choose as GM. But obviously that's Kevin Lowe's boy, and you know, they're bringing him back to clean up the mess.
Richie?
Well, funny how the Oilers had too many depth players years ago, and now they don't have enough depth players, and they have all young stars. I like the way as you broke it down in terms of two different parts to it, and I think the first part is Steve Tambellini being fired. Steve Tambellini hasn't had a good reign there as far as I'm concerned. His moves have really been limited. His good moves, as far as I'm concerned, have really been limited to the draft picks, and you could have put a monkey in that seat. Not to try and be funny, a monkey in that seat to draft Taylor Hall or Sagan, right? Or, you know, Ryan Nugent Hopkins. These were picks that were, you know, there were many options.
Any of us around the table here would know to take those guys first overall. You didn't go out on a limb at any point there.
Yeah, and Ilyakupov. And, I mean, you know, obviously Eberle was drafted a little bit later on. And, you know, Schultz is a nice acquisition free agent-wise. Although, based on his comments, it appeared like Craig McTavish was more persuasive in bringing him to Edmonton than Steve Tambellini was. In any event, I think overall his tenure in Edmonton was not a strong one. He didn't do anything to complement the young pieces that he had, and it was those pieces, those depth pieces we mentioned, that were lacking. And the glaring holes on defense that they've had for the past couple of years are also lacking. Now, you can blame part of that on the fact that they haven't drafted defensemen, you know, with those top picks, like Ryan Murray, although he was injured. So you could look at it both ways, but was Steve Tambellini the guy to take you through the tenure? To me, no. I didn't love the job he did. I didn't like the job he did, frankly.
But you thought this should have happened probably in the offseason, potentially.
Yeah. Others do things in a weird way. I mean, I didn't like Steve Tambellini from the beginning, kind of how he just hucked Pat Quinn to the side, and you know, even Tom Rennie this year. You know, you feel bad for Steve Tambellini in the sense that, well, he kind of put this team together, so to speak, in terms of the draft picks, wasn't able to see it through. Yeah, but he hucked Tom Rennie to the side, and that was the same argument, if not more. So I don't really...
He's not Moses in the desert. He drafted first overall 4 years in a row. He's gonna win eventually.
And breaking it down into two parts, Drew. It's the right move as far as I'm concerned in terms of getting rid of Steve Tambellini, removing him of his duties, relieving him. Excuse me, bringing in Scotty Housen in a complimentary role. I don't have as much of an issue with it. NHL experience is important. GM or manager, you know, front office experience, whether it be with, you know, as assistant GM in Edmonton or head man in Columbus, doesn't hurt to have it. In terms of the hire of Craig McTavish, why the Oilers wouldn't explore other options and then come to the decision to hire McTavish is, to me, the biggest issue. Why not hire interview Paul Fenton? If not just for the ideas that they bring to the table.
Which was to interrupt you for a second, Al Davis, the legendary owner of the Oakland Raiders, Los Angeles Raiders, always used to interview multiple head coaches, even if he had his guy sort of in mind, just to hear what these other guys brought to the table.
And why not explore the other options? I mean, you know what you have in Craig McTavish, and you may say, you know, I feel comfortable with Craig McTavish, but why not check in on other options? That was to me a huge flaw in this decision making. You also keep it in the family, and maybe there's been a lack of accountability in the family. And, you know, and Kevin Lowe, I guess we want to quickly play the clip before the end of the segment here. Kevin Lowe points to his success as a player, and he also points to the organization's success in that Stanley Cup run. That was a miraculous Stanley Cup run that could have gone either way.
Now, are you saying to me you're getting impatient after 3 years?
It's not me. It's the band.
And lastly, I'll say, there's one other guy, I believe, in hockey today that's still working in the game that has won more Stanley Cups than me. So I think I know a little bit about winning, if there's ever a concern.
It's such a backwards argument in this day and age that you have to have had played the game or won Stanley Cups in order to, you know, be a relevant general manager. I mean, you look through the past Cup winners, and none of them, you know, have won Stanley Cups prior to being the general manager.
Yeah, I think it points to his reaction is very defensive. As I know, we got to go up to break, go to break here, but his reaction is very defensive, and for him to react that way to a question, a fairly innocuous question, makes me wonder, you know, how he's dealing with criticism behind the scenes, because clearly it's bothering him. And what's he doing to deal with it? You know, and he's hiring Craig McTavish. That just seems like it's just furthering the problem. I'm not saying McTavish isn't a capable guy. I think he went to school, might have got his MBA, I believe, at Queens during the break, and he's bright. But one thing to note also, Craig McTavish didn't get hired by any other teams as a coach when he had his interviewed by the Jets. Didn't get hired by any other teams as a coach or a GM.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that make you wonder?
Let's go to break. We'll talk about this more when we're joined by Ryan Rashog at around 6:30 this evening. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. This segment is brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, conveniently located at 1700 Cordon Avenue in the Cordon Village Mall. Bernstein's is a family-owned and operated traditional-style deli. Take it home or dine in their full-service restaurant. Bernstein's Deli has been your deli destination for nearly 30 years. Check out their website at bernsteinsdeli.com, now open on Sundays at 9 a.m.
Break it down.
Break it down for this Wednesday evening is going to focus on the Carolina Hurricanes power play. We'll see them in town tomorrow evening to play the Winnipeg Jets. Hurricanes power play is 23rd in the NHL so far this year, a 15.2% success rate. And that should, tell you that it's not clicking on all cylinders. Before we get into the real nitty-gritty details of how they establish and set up their power play, are you surprised that a power play that has, Staal and Semin and Jiří Tlusty, who's really coming into his own, is performing at such a poor rate so far this year, Richard?
A little bit. I am, Drew, a little bit. When you watch them, you can see they have some issues in terms of being able to manage other teams' PK units and then how they're defended. I think they could use a little bit more versatility in the way of another strong passer. Obviously, Jeff Skinner's in and out of the lineup has hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
But they could use another guy. Jordan Staal and Eric Staal are two really good two-way players. They could probably use another playmaker on that roster, and I think that is evident when you watch their penalty kill.
If you're a team that trades for Marc-Andre Bergeron in the middle of the year, and it's happened for the last few years where he's been traded because he's known sort of as a power play specialist, is that a sign of how desperate your power play is?
Maybe. I don't think it's a bad move, though. And I don't know if the point's necessarily the problem. I mean, Jamie McBain and Justin Falk and Joe Corvo and Marc-Andre Bergeron are all offensively capable, and Yoni Pickens before that. I think that's more to do with Pickens' heel injury than anything, Drew. All those guys can move the puck. In fact, the problem they really have is on the back end defending with that unit. But having said that, I think it's, the power play that they have two different formations for their different units. But
so
they're
let's start with Unit 1.
Okay.
Unit 1 features Eric Staal,
mm-hmm.
Alex Semin, who they just signed to that big 5-year contract extension, Jiří Tlusty, those are their three forwards, and on the back end, the aforementioned Marc-Andre Bergeron and Justin Falk. And they set up in sort of a 1-3-1 that we've seen a lot of other teams set up. In your notes when you prepared this, you said very similar to how Washington tries to establish their power play.
When I talk about playmakers in terms of versatility, they don't have Ribeiro and Backstrom. Not many teams do. That's why Washington's power play is among the best, if not the best, in the league. With Carolina, the power play kind of flows through Eric Staal. Eric Staal's a really good player. He can pass the puck. He can shoot the puck. But they really kind of lack that other person to do that. And with all due respect to Staal, who could play on my team any day of the week, Backstrom and Ribeiro are probably still better passers than he is. And I think that shows, because when they pressure Staal, which is what good teams are doing, they're pressuring on Staal on the half boards, meaning Eric Staal is a left-handed shooting player. He would stand on the right hash marks along the boards,
play
along
on
the half boards.
On his off wing.
Yes, and teams are pressuring him, and then the puck's going to different directions, and the power play is then not flowing through him, and that's causing issues for Carolina in terms of setting up.
So what teams are doing defensively to neutralize their power play is to say pretty much, we're not going to let Eric Staal be the guy who beats us.
That's one of the things they're doing, yeah. That's one of the things that teams are doing. I think also there's, you talk about net presence, as Jiří Tlusty is a guy who is going in front of the net on the power play for them, and he's had a really good year, but he's not Dustin Bufflin in front. A little bit more of a presence up front in that regard would also be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, why isn't the Carolina power play doing well? Why isn't Carolina doing well this year? I mean, Eric Staal got a power play goal in their last game. as far as the Hurricanes go, you know, I thought Justin Faulk would be a better power play player. Richie, you're probably right. It probably comes down to not missing a playmaker or two there. And, you know, a guy like Staal can come off the half boards, and he's got a great shot. And he's a guy that can also go to the net, and you can put him in front of the net. But it's, you know, again, what we've talked about a lot here is on the segment is you don't want to have too much of the same thing. And, you know, a guy like Jeff Skinner, he leads the Carolina Hurricanes in goals. He's not going to be in the lineup. Mm-hmm. The Jets won't face him tomorrow night. But, you know, you have some players who are good power play players, but, you know, you also... you don't have a situation where they're throwing as many looks at you as a team like the Tampa Bay Lightning.
Very true.
And, you know, McBain's got a big shot, not the most mobile guy. And Bergeron is, quite frankly, overrated for one or two good seasons that he had. I didn't really like that acquisition. But really, it's a power play that hasn't really struck much fear into the Jets. The Jets have played the Hurricanes a lot this year, and it hasn't been that successful.
Let's talk about their second power play.
Well,
sorry, go ahead.
Before we go to the second, I mean, Alex Semin is obviously the key to the power play along with Staal, excuse me. And, you know, when we talk about Staal on the right half boards, you know, at the top of the blue line is Marc-Andre Bergeron. If you vision it, it was a 1-3-1. Bergeron's the one.
He's in the middle of the blue line.
Yeah, the top. And then you have three along the hash marks, essentially. You have Staal, Eric Staal on the right.
Mm-hmm.
You have Semin in the middle, and Semin has arguably the best one-timer slash wrist shot in the National Hockey League. And then on the back end, where Ovechkin plays for Washington, you actually have Justin Faulk.
Sort of on the left side of the half boards.
Yeah, who's a very underrated defenseman and is coming into his own. And in front, we mentioned before, you have Yuri Tulusti. Now, if the puck goes down to Staal on the half boards, Tulusti will kind of swing to the goal line and give Staal support for a pass. And they can play a little bit of a give-and-go game. But when the puck goes to the top to Bergeron, Tulusti then stands in front.
So Tulusti, when the Eric Staal has the puck on the half boards, Yuri Tulusti moves from right in front of the net to sort of just a little bit lower on the same side of the ice as Eric Staal.
So usually.
So yeah. He's available for a pass if Eric Staal gets the pressure that a lot of teams have been putting on him on the power play.
And what happens is, you know, as he talks about looks, and that's really important because it's movement. If Eric Staal then drives to the net, who covers him, and then does Semin go to the open spot? That's good teams. Good teams move on the power play, as he mentioned, and that's what they have to do to be better.
Richie, I look at the Hurricanes as well, and you know the Jets, as everyone in Winnipeg knows, have not been good this year.
On the power play.
You know, Justin Faulk, I mentioned, is a guy that I thought was going to have a breakthrough season, and he has a bright future ahead of him. He's very young. But, you know, you have a situation again. Remember the year the Pittsburgh Penguins won the Stanley Cup? They didn't have a very good power play. You almost have a situation where you have too many skilled guys on the ice and not enough, you know, room and decisions for them to make because, you know, Carolina is a very good skating team, and the Jets, you know, have dealt with that to a certain degree, but the Jets have been very successful against the Hurricanes dating back to last year. But you really have a situation where you're shutting down the Alexander Semin one-timer, and you're making sure that Staal doesn't come off the half boards and shoot. And then really, you've got Corvo and Faulk and these guys that, you know, they're good defensemen, good offensive defensemen, but really you can set up penalty killers and block that type of shot. And they really haven't put together any type of unique or creative power play like other teams are. And maybe that's kind of, you know, what's happening in the NHL, where now you can't just throw out your most talented players and expect results every time. That might be a theme to, you know, the segment that what we've seen is it helps to have St. Louis and Stamkos, but if you're not, you know, changing up your schemes from game to game, you're probably going to get the same results.
And the other issue, of course, is you can keep doing what Tampa Bay is doing, and you can do what Washington is doing, but when you don't have Stamkos and you don't have Ovechkin, it's a heck of a lot harder.
Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek. When we come back, Ryan Rashog from TSN Edmonton is going to join us. Shortly past 6:30 in the evening, welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca for all of you listening online. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve and follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve.
The TSN 1290 NHL Midweek Hotline.
We welcome back to NHL Midweek from the TSN Edmonton Bureau, Ryan Rashog. Ryan, good evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to join you guys anytime.
appreciate that, Ryan. You know, we obviously have to start with the moves that the Oilers made with their front office earlier this week. Getting rid of Steve Tambellini, hiring Craig McTavish. You know, was this the right time for the Oilers to have made that move?
Well, I mean, you know, the end of the season probably would have been fine too. There are those who would suggest last year would have been a better time. You know, one of the big criticisms of Steve Tambellini was that he was hesitant to pull the trigger on deals, and he wasn't very aggressive. And I think that, you know, had a little bit more been done with this roster, you know, before this season started, that, you know, maybe the outcome could have been a little bit different this year. So, you know, there are those who would suggest it was a season too late. There are those who would suggest that, you know, they should have waited till the end of the year. But you got to remember, they had just been booed off the ice, you know, beaten by the Flames in an embarrassing loss. And the temperature was very, very hot here in town. So, you know, I don't know when the right time is to fire a GM, but when your team gets booed off the ice and you've lost four or five straight and you're out of the playoffs and playing like garbage, that probably seems like about as good a time as any.
Ryan, you touched a little bit on Steve Tambellini's indecisiveness. If you could, you know, pinpoint one or two moves or maybe, you know, a period of his tenure where, you know, that really contributed to, you know, his lack of success or maybe the main reason why, you know, he was let go. What would you pinpoint as far as those moves go?
Yeah, I'd say Alex Hemsky is probably the best example. You know, Alex Hemsky is an asset the organization's had for a few years that, you know, people who have been around this city watching this team for a long time feel, you know, that there's a lot of question as to whether he's part of the answer moving forward. So, you know, last year at the deadline, it was like, what are you doing with Alex Hemsky? Are you trading him? He was unrestricted at the end of the year. So are you going to risk losing him for nothing? Are you trading him, or are you going to sign him? And we were like 8 or 10 days out of the deadline, and rumor broke that they hadn't even talked to Alex about a contract yet. So it was like, okay, what are you doing here, Steve? Are you going to try and sign this player? Are you going to move him for assets? And the rentals at that point, I mean, Paul Gostad went for a first rounder. Now, who knows what Alex Hemsky would have been able to grab them. Alex Hemsky is a good example of an asset that that Tambellini had that just kind of, you know, what's going on with this guy? Theo Pekham is another one. Pekham came into camp out of shape this year. They were mad at him. They healthy scratched him, made him get into shape. Okay, fine. He got back into shape, played four games, played pretty well, and then hasn't played a game since. And they've just been carrying an eighth defenseman on their roster the entire season. Ralph Kruger wanted to go with 14 forwards and 7 defensemen. Well, because they couldn't figure out what they wanted to do with Theo Pekham, they carried Pekham on their roster the entire year and wasted a roster spot on Theo Pekham. Like, what are you doing with this player? Do you want him on your team or not? So either trade him, send him down to the minors and risk losing him on waivers, like, you know what, or get off the pot here. And it's just like, what's going on? And there was a lot of that. And my sense of it is, it's because there was a lot of indecision.
Ryan, in terms of who was making the decisions, was it always Tambellini? Because there was always talk that Kevin Lowe still had a large part in who was going where and who was getting what kind of money.
Yeah, well, I flat out asked Kevin that in the press conference. I said, Kevin, there's a lot of question as to Steve's autonomy to do whatever he wanted. Like, what is the structure here? Are you still running it? Do you have final say? And Kevin insists that Steve had the ability to do whatever he wanted to do. That his role is more as a conduit to Daryl Cates, to keep him up to speed on what's going on, talk about the direction of the team, all that kind of stuff. He insists that Tambellini had full ability to do what he needed to do, and that Craig McTavish has full ability to do what he needs to do. So that's what he's saying. Now, whether you take that at face value and actually believe it or not, it's up to each individual, but that's what Kevin flat out said to me and everybody else in that press conference. I'm not running this thing.
You're listening to NHL Midweek on TSN 1290. We're joined by Ryan Rashog. He covers the Edmonton Oilers for TSN. Ryan, let's move to the guy that they hired, Craig McTavish. You know, it's sort of a two-part question. One, why didn't they interview anybody else? And two, is McTavish the right guy for the job?
Well, I'm not going to say McTavish isn't the right guy for the job because he's been around the game a long time. He's got lots of contacts in the game. He's been in the game at different levels. He was a player. He was a captain. He was a coach. You know, he was a coach of the American League. He was in hockey operations for the Oilers for the last 10 months. As a coach, he was very, very involved in front office stuff like trade deadlines and personnel decisions. He was much more hands-on, I think, than your average coach. So I'm not going to sit here and say Craig McTavish isn't qualified to do this job. I don't think that's fair. He hasn't done it before, though. So, you know, whether they should be hired a first-timer or not is a fair question. As for why they didn't interview anybody else, that is a very legitimate, fair question, and it's one that I certainly posed at the time. There's a lot of really good young candidates out there. You got your, you know, your Fentons in Nashville and your Botterills in Pittsburgh. Sorry, guys. You know, you got lots of good guys out there who probably deserve this. Now, the time to interview these guys wasn't right now. Mm-hmm. You guys remember, Craig McTavish was brought back to the Oilers during the Stanley Cup final last year. They just basically opened up a position, created a position for him, and gave it to him. Well, when you get the green light from your owner to add another significant management piece, you need to say to yourself, okay, this is probably our next, you know, this very well could be our next general manager that we're hiring right now. Mm-hmm. That's the point in time where you go out there and you scour. Everybody else's season is done. You go out there and you do your interviews and you know, back when they originally hired Craig, that's when they should have done their interview process. That's when they should have looked around and put somebody into that management position, knowing this very well could be our next general manager. That's when they should have done that, and they didn't.
Ryan, Craig talked about, impatience and possibly having to make a bold move. You know, without getting into certain specific players, you know, where does Craig McTavish start as far as, you know, addressing some of the, inefficiencies in his roster?
Yeah. Well, I have no issue getting into specific players. I mean, I don't know what he's going to do, but there are some hard choices to be made. This is the way it sets up, guys, plain and simple. Taylor Hall, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, Everly, I'm writing these down as I'm talking, and Yakupov. Those are the four building blocks moving forward. Three of them, small, skilled forwards. Mm-hmm. Hall's not quite as small, plays with a little bit more of an edge. Those are your A1 franchise guys. Justin Schultz, put him in there too. Then you got level B guys. Gagne, PRB, Klefbom, who's coming, and Alashemsky, I would put in there too because he's got another year on his deal. Mm-hmm. Those are the secondary guys, skill guys. So the question is, does he need to mess with those first five names in order to change the dynamic on this team, or can he get it done using pieces from that second-tier group? Oscar Klefbom would get a good return. Sam Gagner's stock is higher than it's probably ever been since his rookie year. Magnus Piarvi showed a lot in certain spurts this year. Alashemsky's probably at this point only going to get you draft picks in return. So what they have to do is they need to add more size in their top six forwards, be a harder team to play against, and some veteran presence. So I would suggest to you that with those four skill guys up front, Hall, Nugent-Hopkins, Everly, and Yakupov, they have enough pure skill up front. They could trade a Gagne to add that different dimension. They could trade a PRV to add that different dimension. They could trade a Klefbom to add that different dimension. They also need to add a little bit on the back end, too. So when Craig talks about being bold, we all raise our eyebrows and go, are you talking about moving tier one prospects here, like those guys, or are you talking about the second layer? Because one is really bold. The other one is, you know, some bold maneuvers that's tweaking of their skill base.
Ryan, do you know anything about Andrew Miller, who the Oilers just, again, Darren Dreger just reported they signed Yale product,
yeah,
Andrew Miller about, I don't know, 10 minutes ago or so?
Yeah, no, don't know a ton about him. The Oilers sent out a release a little bit ago. I know he had real good point totals with Yale. Didn't they just win a championship?
Yep.
Yeah.
I think they just won a championship. Small skill guy.
Yeah.
So add another small skill forward to the mix. But you can't have enough quality in your organization. So it sounds like this guy, there may be a few teams that were interested in this guy and, you know, put up some points, real good college player. I don't know where he steps in. Like, I don't know if they're bringing him here. I don't know if he's going to go straight to Oklahoma City for the playoffs. I don't know what their plan is with him. But, you know, I think adding skill and adding good players to the organization is a priority. So I've never seen the guy play, I can't say. But just from the stat lines, it looks like this is just a guy that a few teams were after, and we'll see where he fits in.
Final question, Ryan. In terms of the way the press conference went down, and you were obviously there, how surprised were you that Kevin Lowe reacted that way and said certain things that didn't come across very well?
Well, I was not surprised at all that Kevin Lowe got pissed off. Like, this is what I've been saying on the radio here, and people are like, oh, how could he? And it's like, did any of you ever watch this person play hockey? Like, Kevin Lowe is a guy that gets mad. He has a temper. He is fiery. He is competitive. He's passionate. You get in Kevin Lowe's face and start to really question him, he's going to snap a little bit. You know, this is a guy who, one day at practice, he was in the stands when he was GM, didn't like a camera shooting him, sitting watching practice. He tried to take the tape out of the camera. Like, Kevin is a guy that's got a bit of snap show in him. Throws phones around in the press box, the chairs. It was not unusual to see chairs flying around in the GM suite. Like, these are traits that made people love him as a player. Well, what do you think? He's just tamed? You think he's just neutered now because he hasn't played the game in a while? He's still the same person. He's fiery. He's competitive. He gets pissed off when you get in his face and when you question him. And look, he made a mistake talking about the two different types of fans. He did. Mm-hmm. I know where he was going with it. Shouldn't have gone there. He made a mistake. Totally owned it today. 100% came out and said, yep, I didn't let the fans make them feel like they were all important, and for that I'm sorry. To me, done and done and done. Like, I just, Kevin's a fiery guy, and I'm not going to defend his record. I'm not going to defend, all of his moves. I'm not going to die on many hills defending Kevin Lowe, but what I will defend him on is his passion and his love for this organization and for its fans. So, surprised that he got mad? No. Surprised that he went there on the fan thing? A little bit. But he handled it well, as far as I'm concerned today. And, I think Oilers fans should realize they've got a guy those are the reasons why they loved Kevin Lowe as a player, was because of those very traits that we saw in that press conference the other day. So I don't have as big an issue with it as a lot of people seem to have.
Ryan Rashog from the Edmonton Bureau of TSN. Ryan, thanks very much for joining us to talk about the Edmonton Oilers. And with the two teams in the same conference next year, we should be hearing a lot more from you.
Yeah, no, I look forward to it. Maybe some new rivalries and some new it'll be good to see some fresh teams and fresh rivalries, and it should be a lot of fun.
Looking forward to it. Thanks again, Ryan.
Okay, guys, anytime.
Take care. Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290. Big thank you to Ryan Rashog from the Edmonton Bureau of TSN for having just joined us here on NHL Midweek. We got one final segment for you on this Wednesday evening. Reminder, following us, the inside pitch with our good friend Paul Edmonds here on TSN 1290. 2 hours of Goldeyes and baseball talk. A quick score update from around the NHL. Pittsburgh is laying the boots to Montreal. It's 3-0 Pittsburgh at the end of the first period there. And in Boston, an emotional start to that game, as you would expect. And the Bruins just capitalized on the scoreboard. 1-0 Boston over Buffalo. Troy Westwood just tweeted this. This is not a game that the Bruins will lose by any stretch of the imagination. There's too much emotion in that building for them to potentially lose that game.
Six things we learned this week.
Commence countdown. Six
things we learned this week here on NHL Midweek. Richard, we'll start with you. The Detroit Red Wings defense can move the puck as well as anyone, but when it comes to defending in their own zone for prolonged periods, they can be exploited.
That's one of the big issues with them, Drew. You talk about Cronwall and Kindle and Brendan Smith and Carlo Koliakovo, Erickson. When they have guys who can move the puck, the problem that this team has is they just can't defend for prolonged periods, especially up against the boards. They still give up a little bit. And defensively, some of these guys still have some growing to do. Understandably so. But the problem is when you lose guys like Rafalski, then you lose guys like Lidstrom, and you're not really replacing them with veterans, the young guys need some time. And I know the Red Wings do give their young guys a lot of time, but another thing to take into account is they're not great at defending in their own zone and along the boards. But the other issue is, where do a lot of Red Wings teams play most of the time? In the offensive zone. And they don't play in the offensive zone as much as they used to. mostly because their offense isn't what it used to be. So there's more stress on the defense. So it's kind of a perfect storm in terms of the trouble they've had on the back end this year. And I think that's probably the main reason why right now they're in eighth spot.
Michael?
Five.
Ezra Ginsberg, the Tampa Bay Lightning need more speed on defense, and the group they currently have is simply not fast enough for today's game.
Richie and I were talking about this up in the press box during last night's game. We've had the opportunity to watch the Lightning quite a bit, and you know, they went out in the off season and they got Sammy Salo, and they, you know, went out and they acquired Matt Carl, a guy who is very good on the power play. You know, speaking of breaking it down on the power play. But, you know, you look at up and down the roster, and they're really not the most mobile unit. And you could really see that, especially in the second period yesterday against the Jets. The line of Andrew Ladd, Brian Little, and Blake Wheeler, and then Evander Kane exposing a guy like Radko Gudas, who was on the third pairing with Keith Ollie, who I really like, former Brandon Wheking. Big fan of his. But, you know, this isn't a very fast group. It's a big group. You got Hedman, Salo, Brewer, Ollie, Gudas. These are all big guys, average 6'3", 6'4". But when you're talking about guys that can, you know, move like Enstrom and Bogo, the Jets are a lot more mobile as a unit. Now, as far as defensively goes, you know, Tampa Bay's got some good defensemen up there. I don't think it helps, by the way, that they've had shaky goaltending. I think that does affect your psyche a little bit. But a guy like Victor Hedman, I know we had Damian Cristadero on, and he was talking about how impressed he was. And Hedman, if you look at the score sheet from last night, he led all players in ice time. A little bit underwhelmed by Hedman, because he's a guy that once you get him running around in his own zone, he still, you know, has problems. He has a lot to learn. So I think, you know, Stevie Y would be, you know, well served to get a more mobile defenseman to complement some of their other the guys they have now.
And as you mentioned, it's big guys, but not that physical overall as a unit.
Right.
Four.
Richard Pulk. Louis Erickson's lack of production this year may be the difference between the Dallas Stars making and missing the playoffs.
The Dallas Stars right now, Drew, are 45 points in 42 games. They are 2 points behind the Detroit Red Wings with one more regulation win than Detroit. And, you know, Dallas has traded Jagr and they've traded Derek Roy, and obviously Jamie Benn has really, you know, finally on the weekend got going. He's the key to their team. But Louis Erickson, for the past number of years, has quietly been one of the best players in the National Hockey League. He has a good wrist shot. He can skate. He's a really good two-way winger, reminding people how good and how much of an impact a two-way player can have. Remember in Dallas, they had Yuri Lehtinen in years past. More offensively talented than Yuri Lehtinen. Out of all years to have a poor one, this is the year that it's been his worst. 26 points, I believe it is, in 42 games. And just hasn't put it all together this year for whatever reason. And I realize maybe they were slowing it down with some older players. But if he had maybe 35 points, 33 points, and he had a better season so thus far, the Dallas Stars may be well entrenched in the playoff spot.
Three.
Ezra Ginsberg, Braden Schenn has taken a step forward this year for the Philadelphia Flyers and is on the right track to become the player that Philadelphia expected him to become when they traded for him 2 years ago.
I really like Braden Schenn, and you know they traded Mike Richards to get Braden Schenn, and everyone remembers how good he was against Pittsburgh in that first round playoff matchup, and he ended up almost being a point per game player in the playoffs last year. He hasn't exactly lit it up this year. He scored a goal last night. He's got 24 points in 42 games. So, you know, you're not going to find his name anywhere near the top 20 scorers. But Braden Schenn is, people forget he's only 21 years old. And, you know, he's a guy that they pencil in as being behind Claude Giroux as their second line center for the next 10 years. And he really plays a really nice two-way game. And you guys remember he was suspended earlier in the year. He's very physical. But I think that, you know, if you watch the way he's developed as a player, he's doing those little things that, much like Mike Richards used to do, back checking and finishing his checks and just those simple things that really good hockey players make. So I think Braden Schenn, even though the Flyers are going to miss the playoffs, I think they're going to be right back in the playoff mix next year. And Braden Schenn's a guy who I would, you know, pencil in as a breakthrough candidate.
Two.
Richard Pulk, putting Derek Roy at wing allows the Canucks to load up two offensively talented lines and maybe ramp up their ice time in the playoffs.
Nobody on that unit, nobody on that forward group plays over 20 minutes a game. I think that's really important to note. Now, on one angle, you could say, well, you know, you ramp up their ice time in the playoffs, they might wear down because they're not used to it. The other angle would be you're saving them for the playoffs because that's where your bread's buttered in terms of the managerial, from a managerial perspective and a coaching perspective. You might be out if they don't succeed this year and at least go 2-3 rounds, as Ben Kuzma said last week on the show of the Vancouver province. But Derrick Roy on wing allows them to play Roy with Kessler and Hansen. That was the line last game. Sedin, and Burrows, you can really load up. And I think what Vancouver likely will do, because they don't have the best depth anymore, is play those guys a lot more. Maybe give them 22, 23 minutes a game in the playoffs against certain matchups. Exploit the other team's lack of depth on the second unit, as opposed to spreading it out all the time. Getting that offense together will be vital to their success.
Ezra Ginsberg, last one very quickly. The 6-year contract given to goaltender Jimmy Howard is a smart move by Red Wings general manager Ken Holland. It gives them stability at the most important position.
I know everyone saw this contract earlier this week, and it didn't really get a lot of press, and I was a little bit surprised, but Jimmy Howard is a very good goaltender, and he's having a very good year. And, you know, I think it might have to do with, you know, his playoff performance last year. And it might have to do with the fact that, you know, he had Nick Lidstrom in front of him, and people don't consider him an elite goaltender. But, you know, he's got a .920 save percentage this year. In his three of his 4 years, he's been above .920. You know, his goals against is low. He plays a lot of games. He's top five or top six in the NHL right now in games played. He's played 36 games. And, you know, this is important, guys, for the Red Wings to sign a goaltender. It's been a while since the Red Wings have given a goaltender a long-term contract. You go back to Chris Osgood and Hasek, you know, they brought him back, and they haven't had a guy, you know, that they've really given a long-term contract to at a very important position. And I think Jimmy Howard is a very underrated goaltender. He's not flashy. He's probably not a top five, maybe not even a top 10 goaltender, but he's a very good number one goaltender, and he's durable. He plays a lot of games, and I really like that signing.
That's it for this abbreviated edition of NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. We'll be back Saturday morning, 8 a.m., with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to Ryan Rashog from TSN Edmonton for having joined us. In case you missed any of the show, it will be available on both illegalcurve.com, tsn1290.ca, and on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/illegalcurve. Right after us, momentarily, Paul Edmonds and the Inside Pitch. 2 hours of baseball talk coming up here on TSN 1290. For producer Michael Remus, for my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. One more time, a reminder, 8 a.m. Saturday with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Until then, we wish you good night and good luck.